Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. Divorce is a challenging time for a family. It can have a devastating and lasting impact on children if they get caught in the crossfire. Perhaps the biggest consequence for children in a high-conflict divorce is parental alienation. Parental alienation happens when one parent supports, encourages, and sets up their child to reject the other parent without justification. The tactics the alienating parent use range from outright lies to subtle, insidious actions and manipulations. The targeted parent becomes increasingly confused, angry, and frustrated, feeling hopeless and powerless to change the situation. Court systems and other helping professionals hold little power to change the thinking of these children and often fail to even recognize what's happening. The alienated parent is left with the choice of either giving up or subjecting themselves to the ongoing abuse of their children. Parental alienation expert Dr. Amy Baker sums up the situation best when she says parental alienation occurs when one parent gives the child permission to break the other parent's heart. Joining me to discuss parental alienation is clinical psychologist Dr. Matthew Sullivan. Dr. Sullivan is a pioneer in the field of parenting coordination, which he helped develop in Santa Clara County more than 20 years ago. Since that time, he has been a leader in the development of parenting coordination across the United States and is a leading authority on parental alienation. Dr. Sullivan has authored numerous articles and is a nationally recognized trainer on topics such as high-conflict divorce, parent coordination, forensic consultation, court-involved therapy, and parental alienation. He has served on the editorial board of the Journal of Child Custody and is the co-chair of the Task Force for Court-Involved Therapy. In 2008, Dr. Sullivan was appointed to a joint working group of the American Psychological Association and the American Bar Association to develop innovative psychological and legal interventions for parents, children, and families. He is currently serving on the Association of Family and Conciliation Courts Board of Directors for both the International and California chapters, and recently won the 2012 Joseph Drown Award for Outstanding Services to Children. I appreciate you taking the time to join me today, Dr. Sullivan.
Good to be here.
I want to take just a moment to remind our listeners how we can be reached. You can call us on our local number at 550-8433. Outside of Anchorage, you can reach us on our toll-free line at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. That's you got to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at alaskapublic.org. Okay, I guess let's start out with this is a tough line of work to work with families in conflict. So let's start out with how you got into this line of work and what you're doing professionally in your various roles.
Sure. Well, I've been practicing as a psychologist for about 30 years and kind of moved into working in the family courts, and the family courts assist parents when they separate and divorce to construct and to some extent implement shared custody parenting plans. So over the years, I've had a variety of roles that are kind of court-based, like mediation, which is working with parents to develop a parenting plan. A custody order is another name for a parenting plan. Usually, you know, the major part of that is just is what schedule the kids are gonna spend with mom and dad. And then, in addition to that, I've done evaluations of family situations where parents can't come to agreement about what should happen with the kids. So the courts have a mechanism to do kind of an investigation, and the evaluator comes up with recommendations. Sometimes the issues are kind of really tough, like if a parent wants to relocate out of, for instance, Alaska into the lower, you know, 48, that's a tough thing to come to an agreement about where the kid should be. So that'd be an example of why there would need to be an evaluation. And then more recently, I've kind of moved away from evaluations into helping co-parents who don't get along, who have high conflict, implement their parenting plans. So even if they've arrived at where Johnny should be during the week, and what the holiday should be, and other structures to their shared custody situation, a lot of parents, not a lot, but probably about 20%, just continue to engage in conflict whenever they have to interact about anything. So that's called parenting coordination or co-parenting work. And most recently, because I work in high conflict, one of the subsets of situations is what you described that we're going to talk about today, which is the alienation of a child from one parent. And I have done work and written on that topic, and have developed some programs for the really severe cases where families actually are court ordered to come to a camp with other families in similar situations and have kind of an intensive week of interventions, or they're required again by the court to come for a weekend to work in an intensive way. So that work has come out of a nonprofit I founded with some other notable professionals in the area. It's called Overcoming Barriers, and there's a website that has a lot of resources for professionals and parents who deal with that situation.
Okay. I have on our website the overcomingbarriers.org, which is the nonprofit you founded, and it does have a lot of resources online, as I always like to remind people. On the Alaska Public Media Line 1 page, we have a lot of resources that people can check out. Just for clarification, you mentioned two things that I wanted to just kind of, we're going to be talking about: co-parenting, counseling, and parental coordination. Can you describe the difference in those two things? Because people would get confused. What's the difference there?
Well, co-parent counseling, think about the partnership when parents separate and divorce, the partnership is no longer their intimate partnership, right? They're no longer their marital partnership. It's all about their co-parenting of their children. So parenting they do in the privacy of their own home with kids. Co-parenting is what they need to do when kids move back and forth, right? They have to coordinate their kids' lives. They have to share information about the kids. And they have to make some decisions about education and about health that they can't make unilaterally. These are, if they have joint legal custody. So co-parenting is that partnership, okay? In high conflict situations where co-parents don't get along, they will tend to get court involved, certainly more often than those who do. And when they get court involved, the courts will try and steer them or even mandate them into interventions. One of them is co-parent counseling, where you meet with a therapist who specializes in situations like this, and they help you to work through your differences so that you can exchange information, so that you can make decisions, so that you can build structures like using email or using a shared calendar to be able to be a successful partner in raising your kids, even though you're no longer in the same home. So that's co-parent counseling. That's a private kind of intervention. It's confidential, so it doesn't have a lot of accountability,
right?
If a parent is not really with the program or not complying. So a different kind of co-parenting work for higher conflict co-parents is parenting coordination, where you actually have an appointment from the court that has some authority, and you're expected to give feedback to the court about how it's going, and sometimes you're expected to make recommendations to the court about things that the parents may not agree about. So if mom wanted Johnny to to be in soccer in the fall, and Dad wanted, ice hockey. That's an example of something that they might submit to you rather than going to court to hear and to try and work out some agreement or ultimately make a decision.
Parental coordination is more like co-parenting with teeth. You have some judicial authority to make decisions. I mean, I met you for the first time in Vancouver at a training on parenting coordination, and it was really eye-opening what you all are doing in California because so many of us are powerless, and I have discovered as a therapist working with high-conflict cases that we can have a parenting agreement between, like, sitting, I can be reading it in my office with two parents, and they'll disagree on every point that they agreed on in court.
Right. And, like you said, other than to kind of shake your head and roll your eyes, there's not a lot of accountability. There's not a lot that you can do. So I think that with high-conflict co-parents, that in general the courts, even though they may have explicit authority, don't really have a lot of practical authority. And that's one of the problems is that, again, as we start talking about kids who resist contact with a parent, that essentially those situations, the parent who is the favored parent is actually violating the court's orders for the other parent's access. So the hope is that parenting coordination for some, because it has that authority, will have people comply and therefore not utilize the court, which is a good thing. Costs a lot of money isn't very effective, and also can keep people with what's really essential, which is that if you have agreements, if you have orders, they need to be followed. Otherwise, it's going to be chaos and even more conflict.
Okay. I want to take just a second for people who might be tuning in late. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is clinical psychologist Dr. Matthew Sullivan. Our topic is divorce and parental alienation in particular. You can reach us with your questions or comments for Dr. Sullivan. Our local phone number is 550-8433 or call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And our email for your questions is line1@alaskapublic.org. All right, let's get right into parental alienation. Can we kind of talk about what it is really quick? Can you define it for us? And then we'll get into the meat of this.
Sure. So parental alienation is a phenomenon that was kind of, it's really an outgrowth of the shared custody movement, because prior to there being a presumption of shared custody, usually moms had sole custody, and so you didn't have a lot of custody disputes. So a good thing, joint custody has become the presumption, but an outgrowth of this is that there are more custody conflicts. And in high-conflict child custody disputes, what was beginning to be seen in the 80s and was coined by the term parental alienation syndrome was, on the one hand, a parent who is engaging in a campaign of denigration and hate toward the other parent, kind of using the kids, poisoning the kids' relationship, and the kids were rejecting and having increasingly negative attitudes and beliefs about that parent, the targeted or rejected parent. And the key to all of that was that the kids expressed attitudes, negative attitudes, beliefs, and rejection were out of proportion to what was determined to be their actual experience. So in the classic parental alienation sense, you have a parent, more often than not, a dad, just because of really attachment issues, particularly for young kids, who's a decent dad, not perfect, but certainly an adequate dad. And you have a kid who comes into your office if you're a child therapist, or comes into court and says, I hope that he gets hit by a car tomorrow, and just goes into a litany of all of these exaggerated or even fabricated criticisms and reasons why they hate that parent. Sometimes they seem rehearsed, and they even seem to be the exact same criticisms that that the favored parent may have already expressed. So that's, you know, that parental alienation syndrome was advanced in the 80s, and it's been refined since to what we now usually call child alienation, that there's a child who's rejecting a parent, or resistance and rejection dynamics, because, Prentice, you can imagine that in some cases, even though the parent who is being rejected is saying that the reason the child is rejecting them is because of the poisoning of the other parent, that that's not the case, and the child is rejecting them for very good reasons that
right.
have to do with realistic experience of that parent. Things like them being harsh or punitive or even abusive or neglectful parents. So you can see where, or if they've witnessed domestic violence before the separation. Those are reasons, legitimate reasons, why a child would reject the parent. So it gets kind of tricky. You can imagine when two parents go to court and one says, you know, the child is rejecting their dad or their mom because of legitimate reasons, and one is saying, no, absolutely not, that I've been victimized by this malicious behavior of the other parent.
So,
see where the he said, she said,
yeah.
Can lead a court or a judge saying, geez, I don't know what's going on here.
So how do we as helping professionals identify the difference? What are the telltale signals? You mentioned one, just kind of ambiguous reasons. They go back to the same thing, like I don't like them, they're mean to me, you know, they make me whatever, clean up my dishes. I mean, it's usually pretty vague.
Mm-hmm.
It's not quite, and they're really willing to share it, right?
Right. Yeah, there isn't. You know, in abusive situations, even, or neglectful, kids are often quite protective still of the parent who has behaved in that way. In these situations, kids, they're hot to trot. They want to share to anyone and everyone freely. There's no sense of ambivalence or guilt. Everything is negative. There's nothing redeeming about their rejected parent. And, you know, there's also an idealization of their favorite parents. So when you ask them about any parts of their experience with the parent they favor, everything is glorious and rosy. And, of course, that's the kind of smacks of an unreality in family life. So, you know, those are the characteristics of the child, that there's this freely expressed rejection, usually exaggerated, sometimes even fabricated, to the point of physical abuse allegations, sexual abuse allegations, which are not substantiated and sometimes not even credible or founded. And then on the favored parent side, there is usually evidence of obstructing visitation. Oh, you can go see your dad this Saturday, but, you know, if you stay here, we have all of this wonderful stuff planned. So you put the child in a place of really having a difficult choice to spend time with that parent. You obviously create, if you're a favorite parent in these situations, a lot of loyalty in that rejection, and there's a lot of exposure to denigration of not only that parent, but everything associated with that parent. So suddenly, beloved grandparents are vilified. You know, the pet German Shepherd who used to be loved. And you can often, if you do investigate these things, you can see evidence in pictures or videos where the child was very positively engaged just, you know, 3 months ago with that parent, and when you show them to them, they'll negate that. They'll say, you know, the only reason I smile for that picture is because my dad threatened that if I didn't, he'd beat me up or something. But it sort of, it smacks of unreality and sort of, and you know, and then there are many other aspects to these situations that, that can give you some sense that that's what's going on, that that sometimes mental health professionals, which we can talk about later, get kind of fooled and end up supporting in a fairly hurtful way this dynamic. Obviously, you can imagine that if a child came into therapy and that a favored parent with a malicious motive brought that child in, that what the therapist might hear might lead them to think, oh, my God, this must be a horrible parent.
Right.
And unfortunately, that happens more often than I would like, certainly as a mental health professional.
So there's an idealization.
Telltale signs that we see when this dynamic, this phenomenon is happening.
So there's an idealization of the alienating parent and a denigration, sort of the other parent can do nothing right no matter what they do.
Right, and that black and white approach is not something that you see except in these situations where the child's expressed views are really much more coming out of loyalty binds, being caught in the middle and having to choose one parent versus the other instead of feeling like they can have a relationship with both.
So it seems cruel to turn kids against a parent who's really not deserving of that or malicious or hurtful. I mean, obviously parents want to protect their children from somebody who is hurting them or mean or cruel, but it does seem... it seems really cruel to turn kids against a parent who loves them. And what is that about for the parent who is doing the alienating? For the one, I mean, what's the motivation behind that? And why can't they see through their anger to know that it's hurtful to their kids?
Yeah, well, I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of usually their inability to do that does come out of intolerable loss and intolerable assault to their self-esteem, which may be vulnerable to begin with. So, what's happening to them personally as they as the relationship with their marital partner or live-in partner fails is that they're just completely shattered and devastated. And that happens sometimes because the reality of that separation is pretty traumatic. It can, you know, think about discovering an affair or a series of affairs,
right,
that your partner has had, or think about, you know, something like a financial deceit or you know, those kinds of issues that you can be assaulted in a way that it really blinds you to the impact on your child and your ability to separate what may be, you know, an adult loss from you know, the responsibility to co-parent. So humiliating separations, intense marital conflict.
Right.
You know, alienation does not just occur in shared custody situations. Alienation occurs in nuclear families that have intense marital conflict. One parent will pit the children against the other parent. So that certainly is a factor that can lead an alienating parent to behave in that way. Then you have divorce conflict and court involvement and litigation. Think about what litigation is all about. Litigation pits adversaries against each other, right? To have it's a win-lose situation when you go into courts. So the child is the prize, and when you hire an attorney and people who are high conflict co-parents will tend to hire more litigious adversarial attorneys, and they actually potentiate these dynamics because they say, look, give me the dirt about your the father so that I can use it to win the case in court. And so that's another dynamic is that kids aren't just acted upon in these situations, but they also have their own motivations. And so knowing that parent A really doesn't like parent B and wanting to kind of be on their good side, they may come back from their parenting time with the other parent and distort and selectively report only negative things.
Right, so they set it up. They may set it up.
Well, that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to let people know you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage, and our topic is parental alienation. With my guest, Dr. Matthew Sullivan. Right now, I do want to go ahead and go to the lines. We have a phone call. Don, you're on the air with Dr. Sullivan.
Thank you.
Hi, Don.
Yes, hi. I'm sure Mr. Sullivan has probably come across some similar case, even though I haven't heard him say anything about it. I missed the first 15 minutes or so on your program, I'm sorry to say. There are cases where, and I'd like you to corroborate this for me if you can, where the parents really don't care about the kids. If they can't have the kids in the situation the way they want it, call them sore losers, whatever, they would virtually are bent on destroying the family, or, you know, there's really no concern about the kids. They can't keep custody of the kids, or lose custody anyway. The idea is to destroy the former spouse. The idea is to ruin them financially, do whatever you can, put them in jail, wreck their reputation, ruin their credit, anything you can. Can you elaborate on some of that for a little bit, please?
Sure. No, Don, I think you're right that because of some of the things that I talked about, either psychologically vulnerable individuals and or a humiliating separation, that some parents simply cannot focus on the needs of their children. It's all about kind of a vindictive and retaliatory stance towards, you know, the other parent, the ex, who has in some way wronged them, and they will engage in all of the things that you talked about, from financial means to ruin to using the kids to hurt, and of course, you know, the latter, using the kids to simply hurt that other parent, is incredibly destructive to the healthy development of kids.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Don. I appreciate it. Seldom do I see parents who really don't love or care about their children. But I do agree with you, Dr. Sullivan, that there are cases where people's own mental health issues and personality traits drive them, and their anger and their fear and their family of origin issues, frankly, drive them just mad to a point where they lose sight of what's healthy for their children. All right,
Just a comment on that. It's not just anger and maliciousness that can drive this dynamic. It can also be fear and anxiety and an inappropriate protective motivation.
They may feel like they're doing the right thing.
There may be kernel truth to a parent's parenting style being not that great. And you may have a parent who's the primary custodian who's just very, very protective, very anxious about anything, about, you know, whether it's teachers or them even being out and playing. And you can imagine that what that can set up with a shared custody situation where a dad may be more loose with how they parent, and all of a sudden, you know, this dynamic starts to occur where mom, if it's mom, is afraid that that the kid is going to get somehow hurt, starts to sort of communicate that anxiety and fear. The child then begins to fear that being with that parent, and now you have, you know, a situation where the child is resisting spending time with that parent. So I just want to underline that it's not always this sort of angry, hostile dynamic. It can also be fear-based.
Great point. We're at the halfway point in our show, so we're going to go ahead and take a short break. Remind folks that you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. Today's topic is parental alienation. If you have a question for Dr. Sullivan or a comment on our topic, you can reach us at 550-8433 or call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email your questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Sullivan. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just joining us, my guest today is psychologist Dr. Matthew Sullivan. Our topic is divorce and parental alienation. As always, you can email your questions or comments about today's show to line1@alaskapublic.org, and you can call us locally at our number 550-8433. Our toll-free number is also a good way to get us at 1-888-353-5752, and you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Please remember, the show repeats tonight at 8, so if you're listening to this on Monday night, you'll be hearing a taped recording, and we will not be accepting phone calls. I do have a caller on the air, so let's go to that right now. You're on the air with Dr. Sullivan. Hello.
Between states. My child is, you know, kind of a victim of this alienation, but she's in Georgia. Would these same laws apply?
I think we missed the first part of your question. Can you go ahead and repeat it? I apologize.
I'm sorry. I have a child who was, there was a jurisdictional question between whether she was going to be in Georgia or Alaska. The matter was resolved in Georgia, and there's some pretty severe, you know, parental alienation to the point where, you know, I have a parenting plan, visitation, all that stuff, but not a bit of it takes place. And I've gone back to the core of the situation, and I'm, you know, I hear what you're saying on the radio about it being equitable, but the court, even to this day, you know, is pretty lopsided. I'm just wondering whether that's normal.
Well, unfortunately, I don't know about normal, but I do think that this is a phenomenon that is just beginning to gain some traction in terms of professionals who deal with it in high conflict, and there's always a leading edge of professionals who understand work and write about it, and a trickle down to courts, so I wouldn't say it's normal, but in some jurisdictions they are much more progressive, And I've seen judges very quickly in some jurisdictions, if they kind of get that this is what's going on, sit the favored parent down and say, look, you either knock it off or I'm going to take custody away from you. And I have to tell you that intervention is a very potent, effective intervention. But like what you're talking about in Georgia, and I can't speak to the particular jurisdiction, there are a lot of jurisdictions where they just don't understand the dynamic. And remember that it's a tricky dynamic because you have a kid, and for a long time it was thought that kids don't lie. For a long time it was thought, and in most jurisdictions, by the time a kid is like 14, kind of the assumption that they should be able to have kind of a determining voice in you know where they spend their time with mom or dad. And these dynamics that I'm talking about are absolutely the exception to those rules, that there are kids who are caught in this dynamic who should have no discretion at all, because the law of the land is the best interest of the children, and it's not the best interest of the children in these situations not to see a parent. And it may not even be in their best interest to live primarily or even have contact with a parent who's engaging in this kind of conduct hurting their child and their child's relationship with the other parent. So, unfortunately, you know, we're working hard to kind of bring this awareness to the courts, but it takes, you know, a long time to do that.
I appreciate the call. I think that's an important thing. The jurisdiction piece is tricky. You should probably explore the different rules and laws and how advanced your state is. I mean, to speak to that, Dr. Sullivan, we're just kind of getting started here in Alaska as far as understanding this stuff. But that's why that 14-year-old, listening to the 14-year-old is why it's so important, I think, to determine whether there is some parental alienation or child alienation going on there. I have an email I'd like to read from a listener. It says, "Hi, I'm an alienated father. There is no way I can overstate the anguish of losing my two children this way. Our visits were terrible. One child would be verbally and physically aggressive towards me, demanding continuously to be taken home to their mother. The other child just became more and more morose and distant. I finally gave up trying to enforce visits. I would have dinner with the kids sometimes, but it was always unsatisfying. The kids would barely communicate. They seemed to just run out the clock. It's been several years into this. One child just left for college and seems to be more open to interaction now. The other, still in high school, also seems to be more willing to respond to a phone call or text. My plan is just to continue a quiet campaign of contact and availability without imposing myself on them. Do you have any other advice?"
Well, you know, it is a pretty familiar story, and, you know, the quote that you read, Prentice, at the beginning about breaking a parent's heart, certainly apt from the email description. At this point, I'm encouraged because as these boys are no longer dependent, you know, emotionally dependent and more mature and more what we call sort of differentiated and autonomous from the favored parent, they are more open to reconnecting. And that's not always the case. And I think that absolutely you should be inviting connection. You should be, you know, through whatever means you can, whether it's internet-based or otherwise, because it is likely that you can build a relationship and have a more satisfying parent-child relationship for the rest of, you know, your life, which I hope will be long and decades long. So it is an opportunity, and one of the dynamics that is very evident is the, you know, when kids are dependent and minors, that they're caught. They can't, it's either or, remember, and once they get more independent, if there's been, kids kids need to come back. They need to know who their parent is, who either they were alienated from or may have abandoned them. It's something that is demonstrated in the literature and just makes sense that you want, you are a part of them. So I would just encourage you to do what you're doing and to take advantage of those opportunities. And most importantly, if you do have a connection, don't engage in bad-mouthing the other parent, even though they, in your view, deserve it. But just try and move forward, letting them know that you want as much as possible to have a healthy relationship that works for them, and don't even mention the other parent, because you'll put them back in a loyalty conflict if you do. So, good luck.
All right, well, Dr. Sullivan, a follow-up question to that speaks right to the next question I had in mind is, how does a parent address that with their, say, 13, 14, 15-year-old kids who are coming to them with a bunch of lies like, dad said this or mom said that about you, and they're just outright lies, and you know that they're breaking all the cardinal rule in divorce, right, is don't talk bad about the other parent. How do you defend yourself, or do you? How do you address this with your children and work to maintain that contact?
Yeah, it is a great question, and I adhered when I worked in these situations for a number of years to that golden rule, which is you don't badmouth your co-parent. And I'd be in situations where clearly one parent was violating that rule and one parent wasn't. And, you kind of have a sense of who's the better parent, right, or who's the healthier parent in those situations.
Right.
But I feel like taking the high road, which is kind of what we're talking about, is not the best situation or the best way to handle it, because there is only one voice in the child's head, which is often malicious and distorted.
Right.
So do you take the low road? Do you say, oh yeah, well, let me give you, my perspective on your mom or your dad? No, because I think then you put the child in sort of a tearing loyalty bind. Who do I believe? I think that it's a tough situation to be in, and you want to be kind of addressing those distortions and lies in a way that kind of takes a middle road. And I think when you're in that situation, you need resources. This is not normal. This is not normal. I just wrote a book with a colleague in Arizona called Overcoming the Co-Parenting Trap, Essential Parenting Skills When a Child Resists a Parent. And it really is a book, it's on Amazon, that provides very practical suggestions for when a kid comes to you and says, and you say, hey, you want to go out to dinner? And they look at you like, and they don't say anything. I don't want to go out to dinner. I hate you. How do you, in the moment, respond to that in a way that has a much better chance of moving things in a better direction? And yes, some of what we talk about in the book is what happens when you hear from a kid as they come in. Dad says, that him having to pay you child support, is totally unfair because you make as much money as he does. I mean, clearly that's one of those classic violations of the adage that you shouldn't badmouth the other parent and bring the child in. My best suggestion is that's a very useful book if you're in that situation. Practical suggestions about not taking the high road, not just saying, I'm not going to talk about that because we're not supposed to, but also not getting into the low road of, oh yeah, well, you think that's bad, let me tell you some stuff about him or her. But it's very tricky, very tricky stuff.
So you're talking about a middle road, which is acknowledge that what the kid is saying and say that's just not true, and here's the, if you have some actual evidence as to, you know, what it is that they're questioning, you can show that to them if it's not, but don't slander and, you know, badmouth and get into a slamming thing.
Yeah, but it's even trickier than that, because when you start saying it's not true, you're going to run up against a factual debate, and they're going to say, yes, it is true. And so I think what you want to do ideally is move to a level of saying, it must be really hard for you when you hear mom saying one thing and you know, dad saying another, and kind of go to the feelings of confusion and anger, and, you know, and try and move into it at that level. You're not, you know, you're not debating the history and the facts, because these kids, they will, you know, they will come at you and say, you're lying. And I believe mom, and you're a big fat liar. And, so you can't go there either. Obviously, if you have some evidence, you might be able to. But it's amazing, even with that kind of evidence, how much kids will say no, 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 because they have to walk the good soldier in the war.
They won't believe you anyway. All right,
exactly.
For those who might be tuning in late, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is psychologist Dr. Matthew Sullivan. We're talking about parental alienation. You can reach us if you have questions for Dr. Sullivan. Our local number is 550-8433 or toll free at 1-888-353-5752 or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. I have an email I want to share with you real quick. It says, this is from a different perspective, a child's perspective. I was emotionally manipulated by my mother against my father in a bitter divorce years ago. As a result, I lost irreplaceable time with my father and his parents. My father was the more stable parent. To his credit, he has always been available and in the wings for when I started questioning my mother's accusations. So I want to encourage the alienated parent to always be there for their child. It is because my father was always there for me during the toughest times in my life that I turned out as good as it is today. To the dad who sent the email about his children being distant and irritable when they do get together, I would advise him to just continue to be there for them. I agree wholeheartedly with what Dr. Sullivan advised this man, especially about bad-mouthing the other parent. That's a neat perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a neat perspective. I'd just like to comment on a couple of aspects to it, which is absolutely being the runaway bunny parent. If you've ever read that children's book about, you know, a kid who just doesn't appreciate and rejects a parent, and how steadfastly that parent says, "I hear you, sweetie, but I'm here for you." That is a critical component. And it's hard because these kids are just coming at you with such vehement rejection, such hurtful stuff, to be able to have the perspective that the child is doing the best that they can. Because frequently, the parent in that alienated position begins to say or think and believe and then say, "You're sounding just like your mother," because they are. But
right.
That's the kiss of death. And finding a way to be present is the key, because if you counter-reject, if you say, "I'm out of here, you're being a little, you know, whatever, a little brat," then you validate that piece of them. And when they go back to the other parent, that parent says, that's your real dad, the guy who doesn't show up for visitation.
Right.
So on the rejected parent side, the message from that parent is very helpful. To do that, you have to have support. You have to have a life beyond your relationship with your kids that is satisfying, because if that's all you got, it's going to break your heart and it's going to be horrendous. So you need a good, satisfying work life, intimate life, and often, you know, some counseling to help you to bear up under the rejection. What I'd say for the alienating parent, because there's a message there from this this listener, is, you know what? fairly frequently, these kids who are staunchly loyal and rejecting of one parent get to a point where they get it, and they, when they do, they reject vehemently the parent who they now realize was basically emotionally abusing them.
Yeah, there's a cost to pay.
They think that you're kind of winning the war, but that's not often the case, and you should therefore, if you have any consciousness of doing it, be aware that it can backfire big time.
Yeah, your adult children will judge you on how you parented them, potentially.
Yeah.
So what you're saying also is as hard as it is, you can't or you strive to not take this personally, this alienation from your children. You stay the course. You stay consistent. You maintain a positive, I care about you. I'm here for you no matter what. Don't take it personal, right?
Mm-hmm. And even if you need to let go, you want to have an opportunity to give kids that message. You want to be able to have some opportunity, ideally in a counseling situation where there's a witness, through a letter, through some kind of sit down with them, to say, you know, I hear you right now. You know, you do not want to see me. You need to understand that I love you. I will always love you. I want to be with you. I'm here. The door is always open. And you want to have that message communicated if you are going to let go, because having the door open, even though the kid will probably say at that point, good, I'm
right.
Glad, thank God, you're finally seeing the light.
You're hearing
that's
me.
That's not really what's going on in their heart, and it will increase the likelihood that they will reconnect and reduce the likelihood that they'll feel like you abandoned them.
So what should a parent do if there is a situation where the kids are coming to their house and they're just not following their rules and they're not following their directions, they're disrespecting them, they're saying, let me live with mom, let me live with dad, and then, you know, this will all get better. What should a parent let that go, or do they just, because they don't really have any parental authority.
Right.
How do they continue to engage?
And that's part of what we try to address in this book, is the fact that you don't have parental authority. You're not. All of the rules of parenting that apply to most situations blow up in your face.
Right.
You know, you can't simply say to a kid, you know, look, sit down at, you know, and eat your dinner. So again, there are more sophisticated ways to avoid power struggles. There are more sophisticated ways to negotiate, because what you want to do, obviously, is have that time as good as it can be. So, you know, it's all predicated on unfortunately, on some authority saying that it's not negotiable whether you spend time with that parent. It is negotiable, the quality of that time. But you know, it is a very hard row to hoe when you have a kid who is not wanting to be with you and rejecting. And I think, again, that's where mental health professionals can be really helpful. There may be ways to engage that child. You know, I would recommend that you kind of be a Disneyland parent, because sweetening the positiveness of the experience can be helpful, and not, you know, being the taskmaster and not expecting that you can be the the authoritarian limit setter if this dynamic is occurring, at least while the dynamic is occurring. You can regain your authority, but if you're starting to lose a child, you have to kind of switch gears and try and preserve the contact and the relationship. And again, counseling is helpful, you know, to have parent-child sessions with someone to get some guidance in dealing with the conflicts that are coming up and some suggestions. You know, these are situations that are not normal, and getting assistance with that from people who know what they're doing can be indispensable. And also, there's a lot written.
It's probably important to find a counselor or a therapist who's well-versed with parental alienation, because it doesn't seem to be a very common thing.
It's not very common, and, you know, mental health professionals can really make the situation worse. So you do want to get, you know, the most competent professionals who work in high conflict, you know, shared custody situations, and have probably done, you know, some reading and have some part of their caseload where they're dealing with this, and not just whoever comes off the insurance list as somebody. That would be my advice. It's a specialized area.
Okay. One quick question from a listener is, how should a alienated child who is now older, or a child who's older and did not get alienated, how can they impact their younger siblings, or should they just stay out of it?
They did not get alienated. I'm going to take it to mean that they had a parent who was engaging in that kind of bad mouthing and denigration, but they managed to kind of hold that and still have positive regard for the other parents.
Right.
The younger things are kind of getting turned on the basis of that same dynamic. I would say you are incredibly important to your siblings in that regard. They will both look to you because you're the older one and more mature, and your ability through modeling, you spend time with that parent and you enjoy it, and through what you should do as an older sibling, which is to advise them and challenge them. I think those are critically important, and I think in the long run, your younger siblings will appreciate that. They won't when they're kids, but, you know, necessarily. But you have a long, long time to be with them, and I think that's your job.
All right. Can you repeat the name of the book, your book that you put?
It's called Overcoming the Co-Parenting Trap.
All right.
Overcoming the Co-Parenting Trap. It's subtitled Essential Parenting Skills When a Child Resists a Parent.
All right.
The first author is John Moran, Moran, and it's on Amazon.
All right.
And
By the way,
the proceeds of all of those sales go to our nonprofit, Overcoming Barriers.
All right. We're out of time. My thanks to today's guest, Dr. Matthew Sullivan. Please remember to check out the links that we have about today's show. Patients needing surgery deep in the inner ear for disorders of hearing and balance have a higher risk of significant complication and have typically been referred out of Alaska. Fortunately, complex inner ear surgery is now available locally. So why not tune into your health and learn more Monday, October 5th at 2 p.m., repeating at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1, Alaska Public Media. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron is our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. I appreciate you taking the time to listen. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.